Welcome to the Cascadian Prophets Podcast, a production of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, empowering people to practice poetry and deepen connections to place, self, and the present moment.
And now part three of our interview with Robert Bringhurst on his epic poem, The Ridge.
Part nine, page 118, begins to get into blister rust. And it sounds like a devastating thing. I mean, if you took the average person on the street, you know, a couple miles from here and say, what do you think about blister rust? They would probably think it's not a good thing. But you write with what comes across as awe or respect. So maybe a bit of that on page page 118.
Yeah. Well, you know, blister rust is in this poem because it took out the white pines. And you see, that's so the blister rust did the same thing to the forest that my school teachers did to human culture. It just erased part of it, and didn't bother to leave any record. By the way, I was here and I erased this. It's just gone. So people walk in these woods and they don't meet any white pine, and they say, "Well, there's no white pine here."
A little like smallpox-infected blankets.
Yes, yes. So this sounds like the beginning of an interesting story. Why did the blister rust erase the white pines? Why did the blister rust come here? Was it always here? How come nobody told me this? It wasn't part of my history of North America, or history of British Columbia, or history of Washington and Oregon, of course. It usually is not mentioned. I have met professional biologists who never heard of blister rust and don't know that there's any relation between blister rust and white pine. Foresters all know this, but it's not like it was some technical detail that should be left in the hands of foresters, like how exactly to fix a broken chainsaw. It's part of the history of the world. It's part of the history of the environment that I and a lot of other people live in. So this, which I, like almost everybody else, was ignorant of until I began to look into it, became another central theme in the poem. Blister rust came to the North American forest because people got into the forestry business and they were shipping trees and seedlings back and forth from Asia to Europe and from North America to Europe and from Europe back to North America. The story is fantastic. People used to ship seeds and seedlings of North American trees to Europe, where they were put in nurseries and grown, and then they were shipped back to North America. This is insane in itself, isn't it? No, I mean, there were people that there. When I lived in Boston, I learned that that not too long before my time, there were people who sent their shirts to Paris to be washed and ironed, and they were shipped back to North America. What kind of sense does this make?
I remember eating pastries on Salt Spring Island that came from Montreal.
Yeah, okay, nuts. But this was called civilization, right? This was called progress. This was called increasing the GDP. In the 19th century, people were shipping trees around like this. And in the process, of course, they shipped the pathogens that came with the trees. And the pathogens came from places where the pathogens were part of the ecology, and so the trees had resistance to them. But you put you take trees from the north of India and you ship them to Europe, and then you take seedlings from North America and you ship them to Europe, and they sit side by side in the nursery, and then you ship trees back from the European nursery to North America, and they bring the pathogens with them, and they land in a place where the trees have no resistance to these pathogens. It's just like introducing smallpox into the Haida culture, for example, where nobody had any resistance to smallpox, and 90% of the population dies. Bang! Well, that happened to the forest, too. Just lucky enough that blister rust only affects five needle pines. And the only five needle pine here is right here. The only five needle pines are white pine and white bark pine. A little ways south, there are more five needle species, and blister rust can get them all. But here it was the white pine, and then later the white bark that it took up. So that's an interesting story. But blister rust itself, you see, is an interesting story too. Blister rust is a living thing, and what a life it has! My God, it's stranger than Martians and Venusians. So one story leads to another. That's the way the myth world works. That's the way I hope this poem works. So you want to hear about blister rust?
I think starting from the top of the page there, 118 would work just fine.
Tough customer, the blister rust, as many fungi are. So don't mistake them for the blind, deaf, defenseless, pliant things they seem to be when you were hunting chanterelles and oyster mushrooms. The fungi have no arms or legs, no eyes or ears or noses, and no stomachs and no mouths, but they have fingers in all pies. Indeed, there'd be no pies or cakes or cooks without them, and eyeless though they are, they see and hear in their own way. They also find their way to dinner, and they feed. Like spiders, they digest their food before they eat, not after. Yet like spiders, cougars, grizzlies, lice, and humans, they are not quite fit for the frontier, because there's nothing they can eat except the living and the dead. Rock, water, and light is not a diet they can handle. They're incapable of chowing down directly on reality, as plants and algae do. So fungi live as we do, one step back behind the lines, fed by algae, plants, or animals, or fed by other fungi.
You have an attraction, or you seem to be interested in some very unusual things, such as the blister rust and such as a certain wasp that you relate on page 143. You talk, in fact, your introduction to your reading, your whole reading of the poem The Ridge at the Quadra Island Community Center, you talked about that. There's only one fictional part in the whole poem, and the rest of it is not fiction, but seems like it. And the blister rust and the wasp that you refer to on page 143 are two perhaps prime examples.
Yeah, did somebody originate the phrase truth is stranger than fiction, or is that just something we have as a species always known? I don't know. But it is the case that life in particular is astounding. It's jaw-dropping. It'll blow your mind if you look closely at it. The five lives of the blister rust, sexual lives, asexual lives, its colonial habit that has to live on some kind of flowering plant for some of its lives, and it has to have a five-needle pine for other lives. It's woven into the lives of other creatures in a way that no one would ever dream up, you know. And this is true of the lives of everything else. Those juncos out there in the seed tray right now are just using the seed tray because it's there, but they're woven into the life of this forest in a way that you might not have been able to think of if they hadn't done it for you. The blister rust is stranger than fiction. And blister rust is only one of many rusts, and the rusts are only a tiny part of the fungal kingdom as a whole, and fungi, as it turns out, are biomolecular terms, our close relatives. We're more closely related to fungi than we are to these trees, for example. That's a little scary, isn't it? You're more like a mushroom than you are like a flower. Who would have thought this? We don't pick up toadstools and stick them in our lapels. We pick up flowers, right? The ladies wear flowers on their, pinned to their dresses. They don't wear Amanita mushrooms, for example. But the mushrooms are our brothers, and they are just as lethal, just as cruel, just as various as we are. So some of them are very dangerous critters, and others good to eat.
Tasty. Yeah. Maybe that explains the current state of U.S. American politics.
Maybe it does.
Yeah. There, and speaking of that, fracking goes back to 1947 in Kansas. I learned that from reading your poem.
Hydraulic fracking. There was fracking before 1947, but hydraulic fracking, which is now the basic method, that starts in 1947. Yeah.
There's something that comes out of that, a line from the poem. We have fracked to death who knows how many trillions of tiny subterranean creatures. And it suggests to me a stance of respect toward these beings.
Yeah.
You talk about Buddhism and understanding that all living things, you know, giving respect to all living things, all Buddhas past and present. Can you talk about the kind of respect and the belief system that would value such tiny creatures and that would point our attention to them as living beings deserving respect and honor?
Well, we're tiny creatures ourselves. If we walk through a redwood forest, you'll be reminded how tiny we are. So redwoods are big, but they're not so big that we can't see the tops of the trees if we get into the right position. People say that aspen groves, for example, can be single organisms, and an aspen grove is so big you might not be able to see one side from the other side. It's a kind of small forest in itself. It gets hard to grasp something that you actually can't see as a whole creature. Never see more than half the tree because half of it's underground, but at least you can see that half and you can imagine the other half. And we have a certain ability to comprehend things smaller than ourselves, so we can all watch dragonflies and beetles and so on with great fascination. We can go to the flea circus and watch the fleas do tricks. But then, you know, they get small enough, they're hard to see, and then they're hard to imagine. So we're confined to a certain number of concentric rings. Things can get a certain amount bigger and a certain amount smaller, and we can still hold them in mind, and if they go over the edge, we're going to lose track of them. We're going to then not think about them, and then we're going to ignore them altogether. Well, if you can get away with it, fine. But if you're in the business of running the planet and you've decided to be the king species and you're going to control the lives of all the other species, you can't afford to forget about things that are inconveniently large or inconveniently small. You've got to take them into account, too. Besides which, if you just get interested in the real world doesn't stop just because it's got small. It just keeps on going, and it gets stranger and stranger as it goes. If you're interested in the truth, if you're interested in where is this place, what is this planet we actually live on, you got to keep going. You got to keep investigating these small creatures. who would have thought that there was anybody living, you know, a mile underground? And you know, 100 years ago, maybe nobody knew that there was anybody down there that far. But people have dug down and found that there are creatures there, just as we've discovered that there are creatures living in the bottom of the Mariana Trench, and there are people living at the on the rim of subterranean volcanoes in temperatures that you know we couldn't begin to tolerate. There are creatures in Yellowstone Park living in those hot sulfurous pools, spectacularly beautiful in mass, where they form these fantastic colored patterns, but you take a single creature out of that, you wouldn't be able to see it at all without a good microscope. They're part of the world. Why is it that we all know about the invisible parts of the inorganic world? We all know about atoms and molecules and subatomic particles, protons and neutrons and so forth, and so few of us know anything at all, even the names, even perhaps the fact that they exist, these little tiny living creatures. Aren't they as interesting as atoms and molecules? Why aren't they part of folklore? Why aren't they part of the science education of every elementary school student in the world? I don't know. I had never thought about them until I read a book that told me that they existed. I mean, I knew that there were bacteria and other tiny creatures, but that there were that there were creatures living a mile down, or even 2 miles, 3 miles down in the earth, I had no idea. Just as we find it difficult or maybe impossible to think about creatures that are too big for us to see or too small for us to see, so we find it very easy to ignore the reality of a world that we don't see, and that's what enables us to, you know, think we can get rid of nuclear waste by putting it in barrels and burying it in Nevada, right? It's a really good idea. Yeah, sure, just put it out of sight, and then we don't have to think about it anymore. How could anybody be that stupid? Well, we do it. We throw shit in the rivers and figure, well, you know, it's going downstream. Never mind that there are people living downstream. Your grandmother might be living downstream. Your daughter might be living downstream. And they might need this water to drink. Why not think about it? Why not think about it? The reason to think about it is that it's practical, but also it will enlarge your mind. If you think about these things that you can't see, your mind will get bigger. You'll get smarter. It's worth it.
You know, it might be a case of, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail, but I hear you talk about indigenous cultures. I hear you talk deeply about place with love for the moments out the window and everything else. And it seems to me all pointing to bioregionalism. Now, I know that you're friends with Gary Snyder, perhaps he's without question one of the most important quote-unquote bioregionalists who's ever lived. But can you talk about what Cascadia means to you, what happens when one becomes Cascadian, and what one might do with that stance?
Well, Cascadia is just one of many concentric circles. I mean, it turns out they're not, of course, circles, and they're not really perfectly concentric, but as a simplification, you know, it's a region within which are more and more regions, outside of which are other regions. The reason Cascadia is a particularly nutritious and interesting and vivid circle to think in terms of is that it's the kind of circle that has been ignored, just like the subterranean life has been ignored. We all went to some kind of school, and they all had maps on the wall, these schools, and the maps all showed political boundaries, you know, nations and states and provinces and so forth. There were very seldom maps that showed indigenous languages or indigenous vegetation or the ranges of mammals like elk and moose and buffalo and cougar and timber wolf, and maps that showed rainy parts and dry parts and forested parts and desert parts. But those maps are at least as important as the political maps, and the boundaries on them are sometimes a little fuzzy, but they're real. They have meaning in a way that, you know, the geometrical boundaries of the state of Wyoming, for example, mean nothing. There's no fact on the ground that coincides with these cartographers' lines. There are places in the world where countries have been defined with the same kind of geometrical precision, and the results are almost always disastrous. Right? The whole Middle East is a mess, in part because British cartographers drew lines on the map, and they created ex nihilo countries like Iraq and Syria. And then each one had to have a separate government, and each government had to defend itself against the other governments, and we end up with people fighting over lines that mean nothing except that they were convenient for a cartographer who'd never been there on the ground to draw on his map. People who might share a language, might share many other things, end up as enemies or smugglers or who knows, because this line has been drawn. Cascadia is real, you know, and because it's real because the earth made it. It wasn't made by a map maker. Map makers have been very important to bringing Cascadia to consciousness, but the map makers, David McCloskey, for example, the great map maker of Cascadia, didn't create Cascadia. He just gave it its name and taught us to see that it's there, it's here. Well, if you think about the geometrical boundaries of the state of Wyoming, for example, or North Dakota or New Mexico or any other state that's, you know, some kind of box on the map, you learn nothing. The lines don't tell you anything about the truth of the world. But if you think about Cascadia, if you look at the map, this fantastically intricate, fantastically rich area, it's defined by real things, like where things grow and which way the water flows and how the earth underneath is constructed. Has constructed itself. So every time you look at the map, you learn something about the real world, and it draws you back into the real world. And so you go back and forth between the real world and the map of the real world, in the way you can go back and forth between the forest and the handbook that tells you the Latin names of the species and the ranges of the species. And so it erases, or at any rate blurs, the boundary between the library and the world. That's very important to me. You know, oral literature is healthy in a way that written literature is not, in part because it lives in the real world. It doesn't get stuck on shelves in inside buildings or put in vaults in basements or something. It lives in the real world, and poetry has to live in the real world if it's going to be real poetry. That's what I want. So, in part, bioregionalism is a cure for bad politics, and we got very bad politics, and we need a cure for it. We need an antidote. We need an alternative to thinking about the world in stupid terms, and thinking about it in real terms is that alternative. Reality isn't stupid. it wouldn't survive if it were stupid.
I'm really grateful for this honor to be welcomed by you, to be able to talk to you in this way, and to have heard that poem in its entirety last night. What a joy and honor, and thank you for this experience.
Well, thank you immensely. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Cascadian Prophet supporters include Diana Elser, a sponsorship dedicated to her parents, whose practicality, humor, and love of family life reflected their experience in and love for the Missouri Breaks and Ruby Valley, Montana landscapes that define their childhoods. And Steinbrook Native Gallery, located near Pike Place Market in downtown Seattle, featuring fine art of the Northwest Coast from emerging and established artists. A link to their site at cascadianprophets.org. Cascadian Prophets is a production of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, founded in 1993. More interviews and lots of information on our website, cascadianprophets.org.